Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 155 for Friday, June 29th, 2012. ATS at the movies.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, 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 friends out there in Webville and every other planet that tunes us in.
Podland.
Podland, yes.
Podlevania.
Yes, John is away, and so I, Peter DiLorenzo, am the master cylinder for the evening. Joining me tonight, Todd Lassa from Motor Trend, always one of our favorites, and of course, the man who knew too much, Jim Hall. 2953 Analytics, and a good friend of the Autoline Empire. So we're running the show. But before we get started, I have a very important announcement that we need to get on the table here. In 2 weeks, don't forget, Autoline After Hours will be broadcasting the second annual automotive draft. We met up with our two analysts for the evening, Scott Burgess and Mark Phelan, and I'll let them explain what the draft is all about. Ben, let's run that.
Hi, I'm Scott Burgess with AL Autos.
And I'm Mark Phelan with the Detroit Free Press.
Come on down and watch the Autoline After Hours Automotive Draft.
Coming up on July 5th on Autoline After Hours, watch us as a group of key journalists pick their choices to run their car companies.
And actually, it's on the 12th.
Oh, you're...
It's like a draft you have never seen before. This year, we even have special categories. They have to pick dead people. They have to pick women. We're forcing them to do it.
And we will have medical personnel on hand to make sure the dead people are really dead.
Make sure to watch July 12th.
July 12th.
On July 12th, we're going to be holding the... the Automotive After Hours... Automotive.
I think that's a wrap.
Gentlemen, before we get into our movie time, I wrote this week about, I happened to see a sneak preview of the ATS, the Cadillac ATS advertising, which is shot a lot of it by Jeff Swart, beautifully on locations around the world, pretty impressive stuff. But as I said in my column, I think, you know, I question whether some people at GM realize the task at hand. I think they had to say, yeah, we're going after BMW.
Well, if you're in the segment, Peter, you have to go after BMW because they define the segment. And everybody's chasing BMW.
Yeah, with the 3 Series.
Yeah.
Which has been on its perch for 37 years. And, yeah, GM absolutely has to you know, draw a line in the sand and say, yeah, we're going after the 3 Series. But I wonder... don't you think, you know, I wonder if some people within GM realize how long this is going to take to even get in the discussion. Now, I think the ATS on paper looks great dynamically. They've got the weight under control, the balance of the chassis. I'm sure the steering is good. Those guys know what they're doing.
They've got two good powertrains in it.
Yeah, two good powertrains. I don't really like the front
end. Not the third.
I don't really like the front end that much, but that's another story. But...
a little too conservative?
Yeah, and I know they've done some fabulous work on the CTS, CTS-V.
Yeah.
And so you know this car is going to feel good and drive well. So what do you think, Todd?
Well, Peter, you and I, we've talked about Dan Akerson quite a bit, and a lot of criticism, but every now and then he says something insightful. And a long time ago he said, well, this will beat the Mercedes C-Class, but he said maybe not quite the BMW 3 Series. I think there's a realistic attitude at General Motors. Now, once it gets to this point of trying to sell the car, PR and everybody else behind the effort will not say that. They're going to say, this is it, we're going after BMW now. I hope and think there are smart enough guys, including Mark Royce at General Motors, to say, no, it's going to take a couple generations.
Well, that's just it. They can go after the 3 Series, and they can have a car. I mean, if you think about it, every vehicle in this segment is a pretty darn good car. And in some cases, they do things better than the 3 Series, but they just don't put the whole package together as well as the public thinks the 3 Series is. I think currently the new 3 Series is a retrograde step from the preceding car. I'm sorry. I just do. And that's an opportunity for anybody else playing in the segment now.
That's a great point. I mean, the BMW is more... It's a better target now than it was a generation or two ago.
Absolutely.
Because of the way everybody is kind of adapting to all the technology and putting a lot of stuff in between that gets you a few degrees away from the driving experience than you were before.
Well, yeah, and we've talked about this before, the democratization of this technology. It's available all around the world, and, you know, Kia is going to show up pretty soon with a competitor to the 3 Series.
But the ATS is a car that they can get it absolutely right this time. And the problem is, because they had zero consideration against the 3 Series, to make people consider it, one of the things they have to do is make sure that it is appreciably better in key metrics. Now, arguably, in a perfect world, you'd basically try to get everything better. And even if you did, there would be customers that would drive them back to back and say, no, the BMW is better. Because there's a subjectivity to our perceptions of cars that's tied to the hood ornament. Mm-hmm. It just is. Conversely, they can actually be a serious vehicle in the running after, or probably during, the second generation vehicle. The first generation vehicle is going to be about building consideration, saying, look, we play in that field, and then people think about them. Then once they've got that, then they have to go head-to-head and really fight with them. But we're talking about a 2 or maybe 3 product generation thing.
So we're talking 9 years, 10 years.
Maybe 15, yeah. Peter, because a generation now is 5 years with investment the way it is.
Right.
You know, but they have a vehicle now that looks like it's going to be one of the best cars for weight in the segment. Alpha's a pretty good platform from a mass standpoint. They did a good job managing mass.
Well, you know, they've demonstrated that they can do it. I mean, Mark Royce is a true enthusiast, and he's got great people. I mean, they've turned out some fabulous cars, really. I mean, I don't think they get credit a lot for what they've done.
The design is interesting because when I saw the car on the stand, first of all, it was in red, you know, which doesn't do the car a lot of favors. And I'm looking at the car, and it's like, yeah, okay, I suppose. And in Detroit and in the burbs, I've seen now a couple of them running around on the road. I've seen white non-metallic, which means it was an early build car. I've seen a gray car, and I've seen a black car. And when I see them on the road, it comes across very different than it did on the show stand, and the front end has some more character.
Well, it's funny. We've talked about this a lot, John and I, but, you know, you have to see these vehicles out on the road, because when you see them on the show stand, you don't get sense of presence. You know, you're not driving, all of a sudden see one coming at you, see the stance, see everything else. Under the show lights, it's kind of deceiving.
But even if the styling is conservative, I've seen a few on the road, and the car looks taut, it looks to be the right size, and it looks like a Cadillac, and I think it carries that off at least.
See, what's interesting about the car to me is it has more presence in the rear than the XTS does, and that was a surprise. The XTS in the rear is sort of anodyne. It's got all the Cadillac cues there, but not a lot to make it distinctive.
Although the XTS looks great coming at you.
Absolutely, and side views is pretty striking.
Yeah.
And the ATS coming at you is very distinctive, and in the rear it's more distinctive. Plus, they did something nobody else has done. A lot of companies will take a piece of chrome and put it above the license to make a license plinth. On the ATS, it's at the bottom.
Yeah.
And it actually, on dark-colored cars, it's like, whoa.
You know, here's the thing about the XTS versus the ATS, though. They're both coming out about the same time. The XTS is actually a little bit ahead of the ATS. And the XTS is a very important car for what Cadillac is now. To the enthusiast, it's not an important car. The ATS is an important car for where Cadillac wants to be. And the funny thing is, of course, at Motor Trend, on the Auto Extremist, you know, everywhere, anytime we talk about Cadillac, we'll be talking about the ATS, good or bad, over the next several years. The XTS will just be, eh.
Well, you know, the funny thing is the dealers desperately need the XTS.
Absolutely.
Because there's still a residual Cadillac buyer out there that has had nowhere to go. I mean, they were confused by the STS and the DTS, the DTS followed by the STS. You know, so I think the car will do very well, and I've said this for a while. I think Cadillac's going to be surprised. All their effort's going to go in the ATS, and they're going to be surprised in how much the XTS really performs in the market.
Oh, I think it'll perform well in the marketplace again. But again, for where Cadillac is now.
Yeah. I understand. And the XTS, it's kind of interesting because an MKS is almost the same length, but it looks shorter because it's so much taller.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you know that here's Lincoln rudderless trying to figure out what Lincoln needs to be. And the MKS is, in fact, an XTS competitor. And it's going to be interesting to see if they position it that way.
And the new MKS with the tweaks is really good.
It's a better car than it was, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't have the presence.
The new
it's better.
Good.
Yeah, but the thing is, the XTS cuts a better swath in. And the MK, absolutely. The MKZ is going to be a pretty striking car, too.
Oh, Cadillac actually would be, it would be good for them. It would be a good idea from their point of view if they just ignored the Lincoln, you know, and went after the Germans, even though that car probably can't compete.
Well, that's Cadillac's stated goal. They go head to head with Germans. I think the MKZ is a whole nother ballgame. That's a quite striking car, and I think they'll do well. So,
although I think they've sort of missed the cue there when somebody said, well, you know, with all-wheel drive and the six-cylinder engine, we can go after the 3 Series with this. And I'm thinking, this is the same company that said they could go after the 3 Series with a Contour SVT.
Who said that? Someone at Lincoln?
Yeah, someone in the organization that will remain
nameless.
It's
not on the same page as where most of the people are
because,
down there.
Because the truth is, the MKX looks like it's going to be a dynamite competitor to the 300 or the ES350. It really, that's the car.
I think the MKX is really good.
It looks great.
Yeah. So, what have you guys driven lately that you can talk about? I know you've driven stuff that you can't talk about, but is there anything that you've driven that you...
Well, it's funny. I tweeted today because today's an extremely hot day in Detroit.
I saw 102 coming over here.
And I tweeted. I took a picture of the dash when I was at the IP when I was at a stop. The question was, which number is crazier? I was driving our long-term VW Passat TDI, and it was showing 101 degrees, and from my drive from Chelsea from the Chrysler deal, showed 51 or 52 mpg.
I skunked that. When
I know you skunked that, but I mean, this is just one drive and trying to get through traffic. I drove the Focus ST in France last week.
In Nice, right?
In Nice, in that area, yeah.
And hellish assignment.
Tough duty.
It is. It's horrible.
It is tough duty.
But somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. Yes. And
what'd you think?
I thought the car was good. I thought it was very good. There's some problems I had with it, but you found it.
Everything
good job,
is online.
Man. Yes. And I thought it works well. I think it's a good competitor for the VW GTI, certainly for the Mazda Speed 3. Now you have the problem where the car is anywhere from $26,000 to $30,000, and you want to get the Recaro seats at the very least.
Right.
And that first package is an extra $2,200 and change on the $24,495 base price. Great. It's competitive with GTI, but now you have cars like the Subaru BRZ and the... So now the question is, will the young or maybe older buyer need the five-door hatchback body, or will he or she say, hey, I can get rear-wheel drive for that money, even if it's down on power?
Well, we had a CLS 63 Mercedes for a week. Well, actually, it was cut short because the battery died.
Challenging to look at. Whoa.
Yeah, it was, nice inside and... what's not to like about that motor? It had the extra power pack on it, so it was 550. We bandy about these numbers, 550 horsepower, like it's nothing.
It's nothing, exactly.
But it isn't. It's very much something in that car.
I remember driving that car last year and getting it up to an indicated 192 and standing on the brakes with both feet at that time. And there was a video crew in the car, too, I think.
Yes, there was.
The performance of the car is absolutely—it's astonishing. The steering is not good enough for the car.
No,
it really isn't. And I wish it was in the previous generation SL or CLS because it was a far better looking car.
What else have you driven lately that you can talk about? Aren't you driving the Larry? I call Lexus Larry, but
yeah, I've got a GS 350, and it's a very nice F Sport, very nice car. It's an astonishingly good compromise, even though it has little tiny rim protectors on large wheels for our lousy roads back here. They've got the Sport and Sport Plus settings on the F-Sport, which makes it a more interesting car to drive. And it's interesting because I spec'd it out versus a E-Class, an E350, a 550 or 535, and an Audi A6. And comparably equipped, so the performance is comparable. This is $10,000 less. Hmm. And, you know, it's got weird steering, but it's not... There are worse electric power steerings. It's slightly on the odd side, but still, it's a heck of a thing for the deal, or a deal for the money. And the interior is very, very well done on that car. That's a very nice interior. Hmm.
Well,
I like the psychotic front end, too, but...
I don't. Well, whatever. They had to come up with a road presence, and that's their
They got it.
Yeah, they got it. Well, you know, we're going to shift gears here because, really, tonight's movie night, and we have a lot of movies to talk about, car movies, car-oriented movies.
Movies with cars.
Movies with cars, movies about cars with no cars in them, you know.
And movies about drivers.
And movies about drivers. So that's what the focal point of this tonight, this show is. So, Todd, I'll let you open proceedings and bring up a movie you'd like to talk about.
Well, let's see. Should we talk about Senna? Let's start with that one.
Yes.
Because that
has... There's a movie not about cars, but about a driver.
About a driver, yes. But there are cars in it.
Oh, we can only hope.
About the singular focus of Ayrton Senna, which was... I mean, let's face it, focus is the key for a champion race driver. Those that can focus beyond normal human...
And, of course, the great quote from the movie is, and this is a documentary, of course, if you haven't seen it, and uses all found footage. The quote from it is, he says, if there's a gap and you're not filling it, you're not a racer.
Yeah.
And the movie does a pretty good job. I know that Jim has some disagreements with me. I think it does a pretty good job of presenting who he is, especially to a lot of people who didn't know. I mean, I've, you know, watched him.
This is Senna when he's karting.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
watched him race in the 80s and early 90s.
The hottest F1 drivers start in karting, apparently, now.
Well, it has been.
And for a while,
I mean,
yeah.
But that's, it's interesting that it's...
For going on 20 years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I went to the movie with my wife, who has become a Formula One fan.
But
she would say it to Fosse only in the last 5 or 6 years.
So she knew nothing about Senna, so I bet she that's a good barometer. Of
yeah, and she liked it. I think she learned enough about him and about the politics he dealt with as a racer. And obviously, you know, documentaries are not necessarily supposed to be objective. I mean, they take a point of view, whatever it is, and the point of view was very much that you know, he was screwed by the politics, but he was obviously a very strong character, and I think that comes out. Now, Alan Prost fans will not like the movie.
Yeah.
My complaint about the film is that it's, again, and I like and have followed Formula One, it's very one-dimensional in that respect, because it is simply about an individual, and it doesn't give you, it doesn't get into, it gets into the things that are surround Formula One, but only peripherally, and they're sort of, in some cases, mentioned and then thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
And it, in that respect, it comes across as overly simplistic about his field of work, the thing he did for a job. And it makes it's not that it trivializes it, but it makes it look very simplistic. And if there's one thing Formula One is not and never has been, is simplistic.
That's true. But to present that to a wide general audience is, I think, the point of the movie.
Yeah, I think...
And I think it does that well.
I appreciate what you're saying, Jim, but I think that's the point. When people who know nothing about it found interest in this film, I thought that was pretty amazing because, you know, Senna's been gone for a long time now.
Yeah.
And especially 94. Formula One in the U.S.,
yes.
You know.
Because there's another film that I actually think is a far better documentary about racing and about a driver, and it's a film from, I believe, 1980 or 90, and it's Fangio, A Life at 300 per hour, because it was in, that's 186 miles an hour, 300
right.
kilometers per hour.
Right.
Because it gets into a couple of things. One, it shows this guy's entire life in that from when he started racing. And
which was late in life.
Very late in life. And not only
was
that.
Was he 38?
His car was a 39 that he first raced. The old
Chevy. Right. I mean, he was.
But yeah, he was. He was in his 30s. Absolutely.
By the time he raced Grand Prix, he was far older than Ayrton Senna when he died.
Correct. And far older than I think anybody racing in Formula One now, with the possible exception of Michael. All right, you know, and what's interesting about it is it also goes into a time when racing wasn't just about Formula One to be the best racer in the world. He would race the equivalent endurance cars. Formula One, when he was racing at Grand Prix cars, there were times they had envelope body cars. He raced for Mercedes. He started racing in a race in the Andes with his with a Chevrolet that was cut up, David E. Davis owned for many years. Yeah. It's an amazing car. Mm-hmm. And the movie actually shows the development of motorsports, and it starts with racing long before Fangio was racing, where you see these cars crash, and it's stuff from the teens or maybe even the aughts of the last century, and the cars sort of roll over on their sides, and the driver and the mechanic get out, and they turn it over, and they start racing again, and they keep showing clips, and the turn, suddenly the cars are going off farther, and the people aren't moving afterwards.
Yeah.
So you when know, Fangio started racing, it wasn't when it was the most deadly sport, but it was an astonishingly dangerous sport. Yeah. And I'm not saying it wasn't when Senna was racing.
Right.
Obviously. Yeah, obviously.
But, and it sounds like a great movie, and I have not seen it. I don't know if you have, Peter, but have you seen that?
The Fangio film? No.
It is murderously tough to find.
They've just brought it back.
I think we'd all love to see it, but again, the point is that I think probably for the casual observer or for the newcomer at Formula One, the Senna movie does well.
Okay. Actually, there's a gentleman in Chicago, motorsport collector, who's really a good guy, and he always has this stuff. And
he has a copy of Fangio.
Yeah, he had the Fangio film on his site recently, so he might have some copies.
It's an amazing, and it's
so
an
this is a reissue. We'll be able to watch. We'll be able to find it more easily.
I would hope so.
I would think so. Good.
David E. showed it at the State Theater as a party at Automobile Magazine, one of their anniversaries. I think 10th anniversary, and it was on the big screen.
Well, we're going to take a little break before we get into Jim's first film, and we'd like to hear from our good sponsor, Bridgestone. And thanks to Bridgestone again, and we're back for our movie show. Jim, what's the first movie you'd like to talk about?
It's a movie that's done by a French director, writer, star, that in every movie he's done, you can tell he loves automobiles. And the guy's name is Jacques Tati. His first feature film was a film called Jour de Fête, Holiday. Then he did a film called La Vacance de Monsieur Hulot, Monsieur Hulot's Vacation, My Uncle, which has a fabulous car in it. It has a three-tone purple, red, and green 56 Chevrolet that's owned by these people that own a modern sort of hyper-Usonian house
a
in France.
A 56 Chevy four-door hardtop.
Four-door hardtop, and this is in France.
Yes.
There's a scene where Hulot lights his pipe with the car's cigarette lighter and he throws it out the window because he thinks of it as a match. But he plays the same character in most of these films, a guy by the name of Monsieur Hulot. And he did a film, his last feature film was a film called Trafic, T-R-A-F-I-C. You can tell watching it that not only does he love cars, he loves certain things about each car, and he could identify things about them. There's a spectacular, massive car crash scene when a guy is directing traffic poorly. I believe we're feeding it now. And this is astonishing when you watch the action that happens here. And of course, there's the DAF, and the Mini gets through. But watch when the Citroën slams its brakes on. And if anybody knows what Citroëns do when you put their brakes on, they're just awful. Literally, this is one of those films, when you watch it, you can tell. He absolutely loves automobiles.
Mm-hmm. And this is from 1971, if I
remember, right? I believe so. And it's about Monsieur Hulot, who has to drive a camping car to the Amsterdam Auto Show from the builder in Paris. And the whole movie, there's a scene where a man is using a screw jack to jack his car up, and every time he bends over for the screw jack, there's a space in the cars going by. And it wasn't digital. It was done by the most insidious thing of all, choreographing a car chase, or a auto sequence. The movies, it's a laugh and a half. You don't have to know any language at all. You can even see it without subtitles, and it's funny.
Tati is basically a silent filmmaker
from
the 50s, 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, his movies have dialogue. In fact, Art Buchwald wrote the dialogue for one of his films, and it slips from French to English to German seamlessly, and you sort of don't care because
there's
of the imagery.
A few words here and there.
Yeah, the pictures are so amazing. And this is available on DVD from the Criterion Collection, which means there probably is not a digital download of it.
Just saying, Art Buchwald wrote that. It's just unbelievable.
He did a lot of stuff for film.
I know. I mean, he was an amazing guy.
It's an astonishingly entertaining movie, and it's one of those things that once it starts, you don't want it to end.
Yeah.
And it's very, very good.
Cool. Todd, what do you have next?
Well, I'm going to mention one that's not a car movie by any means. I'm going to get into Body Heat. And the only reason I bring this up is Ned Racine's car. Actually, all the cars in it are well chosen. And I think there's, for car guys, there's something about having a director who is careful about which cars he or she
uses. Casting cars
rather than, oh, Chrysler or BMW or whatever is giving me free cars, so I'm just going to, you know, try to fit them more or less to the character. And Body Heat does a pretty good job of that. Ned Racine has this faded C2 Corvette convertible that you see driving, and there's some great scenes of it driving up and down the coast in Florida. That's not what most people remember the movie for. It's mostly for Kathleen Turner.
When she was an ingenue.
Yes.
And still had that whiskey and cigarettes voice even then.
Yeah.
Even I wonder what she was raised on.
Both, obviously.
Yeah, I guess.
And she, I believe she drives a, it's been a while since I've seen this, but she has a big Mercedes sedan from the era.
Yeah.
And her husband, who's the subject of the plot, basically drives a early 80s Cadillac Coupe de Ville, white one.
Richard Crenna,
yeah.
Interesting Richard Crenna seems like a Coupe de Ville guy to me anyway. No matter what part he's in, he seems like a Coupe de Ville
guy. The funny
guy.
Thing is that the great thing about the casting of the film is that Crenna in the 60s would have played the William Hurt role.
Right,
and now
right.
he's the kind of the older guy in that.
Yeah.
Just nice casting of cars. And another director I would mention, this is Lawrence Kasdan. George Roy Hill, I've always noticed, was always pretty careful about casting cars. And the one movie I can think of just off the top of my head is his version of Slaughterhouse-Five. There's actually, I didn't mention this ahead of time, but there's actually almost a chase scene with...
the pinched exhaust.
Yeah, Billy Pilgrim's wife driving the 67 Cadillac Coupe de Ville when she thinks her husband is dying and she's racing and crying to the hospital. And it's intercut between him giving her earlier that year the car as a birthday present, cut back and forth between her destroying this car on the way to the hospital.
And it pinches the exhaust and I think she dies.
She dies instead of instead of him.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Has anything ever happened to it? And then here we are intercutting because he's unstuck in time. Billy Pilgrim
sort of
disappears from where he is, and he goes back to other periods in time, including the future. And it's a
Kurt Vonnegut fans will know all about
yes.
it.
Yeah.
Speaking of going back in time, and completely off subject, but Cape Fear, the remake, had Robert Mitchum, who was the bad guy in the original, but the remake had
De Niro.
De Niro, which was just a freaky, scary part for him. Howdy, counselor. That big cigar, and he's laughing in the movie, smoking a cigar in a movie and laughing, just like cackling. Oh,
see, and it's interesting you bring De Niro up because he is in one of my favorite movies where cars have a critical part in the film.
Taxi Driver.
Ronan.
Oh, Ronan.
Ronan.
Was
and
great.
Ronan is one of those films we should have talked about in the Autoline show we were going to do. We did on cars.
Yeah, we didn't get to Ronan.
We didn't get to Ronan.
Well, that could be a whole... segment.
Yeah, because Ronan is it's an amazing film from an amazing director who we knew loved cars.
Yes.
Frankenheimer from Grand
John
Prix.
Frankenheimer.
It was
Grand
first,
Prix.
It was his first big movie, really.
Yeah. What?
What?
After Grand Prix. He did some other ones, but that was his first big car movie.
Car movie, yeah. But I mean, he did Manchurian Candidate.
Well, right,
I mean,
right, right.
And the thing is, he's been one of those directors that is meticulous. He loves film, and he loved film, and you know, he unfortunately lost him. But his last great movie really was Ronan, which is a good story. If Ronan didn't have the chases in it, it would still be a very, very good film. That sort
the
of
the chases were great,
and the chases. I'm sorry, go on, Todd.
No. The chases were great, but I was going to mention De Niro since you brought him up. I was looking at YouTube just a couple days ago, and I found him in a commercial for a 1970 AMC Ambassador. And I remember the commercial from when I was a kid.
I'm sorry, what?
Robert De Niro,
an AMC Ambassador commercial.
AMC Ambassador commercial.
Ran
and
in
he
the US.
Plays, his parents run like an Italian grocery and a small Italian grocery in New York. And he's just come back from college, got his first job after college. He's a fancy bookkeeper, and he drives up in this AMC Ambassador.
And they think he spent too much money, probably.
Exactly.
Showing that his parents have no concept of cars because they live in New York, and everything has to be yellow with a light on the top.
Well, remember, the Ambassador in 69 was, I think, probably the first American car other than a Cadillac, Lincoln, or Imperial that had air conditioning and standard equipment.
And throw pillows.
And throw pillows.
They had throw pillows in the DPLs. But with Ronan, the thing is, there are two car chases, and they both are pretty much essential to the film, especially the first one. And the film takes place all in France. It has a fabulous cast. I mean, it really does.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I've forgotten the woman's name. McElwain. It has Oh, gosh.
Yeah, exactly.
The bad guy. The Irish bad guy. Mm-hmm. That was a heavy in one of the Bond films. Oh, why have I blanked out on him?
He's got the professional, the guy who plays the professional.
And the first car chase takes place in outside of Nice, and it's in a little town that's, I think it's Saint-Martin, that's up in, like near the Moyen Corniche, and they race down a hill, and they have a car that's basically their pursuit car. It's an Audi S8 with nitrous. And their other chase car is a Mercedes-Benz 6.9. Yeah. So they have two really good, high-powered cars. Law's rocket gets fired at a Peugeot that has protective guys in it. It's an unfortunate end for them, but not for the Peugeot. The chase goes into Old Nice, and then it ends actually in the yacht harbor. And it's a rather spectacular chase that was shot without undercranking. And it was very, very well choreographed because they're driving big cars on very narrow roads.
And another interesting thing about that chase scene is that you see ancillary cars, normal people driving along who get hit, and it looks like they meet a bad end. You don't see
not the harmless
exactly.
cars of and,
yeah,
and the
exactly.
cars the cars that are actually in the chase are being damaged sequentially.
Yeah,
unlike Bullet. And then there's a chase in Paris, which is far more spectacular and has some of the greatest scenes of De Niro driving a car fast because he looks like he's scared to death. He's going like, I mean, he's really frightened in it. Yet again, the choreography of the chase is good. The story behind it's great. It's a post Cold War, fall of the Soviet Union spy thriller, and it is extremely interesting about the politics of what happened to a lot of people that were actually in the field. Mm-hmm. It's well acted.
Yeah, it's-
Yep, there he is. In fact, this is the sequence that we're seeing now is the sequence from the Paris chase, which has him in a Peugeot chasing a BMW, I think it's an E39 5 Series, which is borderline unbelievable.
Yeah.
There's
a
guy that gets knocked off a motorcycle in this, and it looks like he would have been very badly injured, and it was actually in the chase.
Right.
They bought they leased a bus they crashed into for part of it, and again, sequential damage. The problem with this chase is that there are a bunch of cars on the quay, which is the road that runs westbound on the north side of the Seine and eastbound on the south side of the Seine, and where the chase is going on there, if any cars hit anything, sparks come out. That's where it, and I know why it's done. It's done to make the chase more dramatic.
Of course. Yeah, you can't avoid that. But you hear a report about sequential damage. Do you happen to know how many cars they used, how many identical Peugeots or
apparently they used one S8.
Uh-huh.
At least one car. That's why it has sequential damage.
That's why I asked.
And I believe it was the same with the 5 Series, but they had a 5 Series on a table, which was a trailer. They could actually put the crew, the cast in it, and swing it around while they were driving with cameras attached to it. Because some of the things they're doing with that 5 Series, you wouldn't want actors in the car when you did them. They're rather spectacular. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where they're going completely the wrong way on the freeway. The irony was that part of the chase takes place in the tunnel where Princess Diana's car crashed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was filmed before that happened, that sequence. And it's really kind of weird when you're like, eh.
Yeah.
But it's an impressive film. The acting, nobody does a bad job in it. And it has one of my favorite actors, Jean Reno, in it.
Yeah, that's who we're trying to think of, the professional.
Yeah, Jean Reno. I was thinking of the English actor that plays the IRA character in this, and he's
always the bad guy.
He was the voice of Infinity for a while,
right?
And here we are in the chase on cobblestones. Which, if anybody's ever driven cobblestones fast, they are terrifying. They're genuinely terrifying.
So, what other movies, Todd, are you thinking of?
Well, we were also. How about Diva? Are you ready for Diva? Since we're on a French kick,
yes.
Paris too.
And there's a great chase scene in it, actually, between...
Set up Diva, because a lot of people don't know Diva.
Well, gosh, where do I start? It's actually got a couple of plots. The Diva is an opera diva who's never been recorded. She believes in the purity of doing live, singing
once.
Live.
Yes, and singing once.
Once. Right. And so she's never been recorded. The hero of the movie, a young man on a motorbike, on a Solex, records one of her concerts, and then there are the two Korean mobsters. What were they after again? Remind me. See, it's hard to remember that.
It is, because you're right. It's multiple.
Oh, it's because of the international prostitution slash slave ring, basically,
right.
Run by
the Korean Mafia.
The Korean Mafia, and connected with the police chief or one of the high officials in the police department in Paris, who, by the way, even though he's in Paris, drives a, I believe it's a 67 or 68 Cadillac Eldorado. So the cars in this, again, interesting casting. The other hero, the older hero of the movie is who is trying to stop a wave, drives a traction avant. And actually, he's got a couple of them, and to tell you more about that would be giving it away. But this is the chase scene. This is the young man on the moped. And
I think that's at the Palais Royal, I think.
And the cops are chasing him in the, help me out with the car, Jim.
It's a Renault 16.
Renault 16,
Renault DC.
Okay.
Yeah,
I've seen the movie many times, but it's been a while.
And the yellow headlights of Paris back then, which
yes.
made Paris so wonderful when you drove around and all the cars had yellow headlights.
And he runs down a,
into the,
as you can see,
goes into the subway.
Into the subway, when they have to stop and run after him. Some nice scenes in the subway there.
And some great music, too.
Great music, yes.
Even if you don't like opera, it's very well done.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. La Wally, which I didn't know of until I saw that, but it's actually quite good.
What about you, Jim? What's another film?
Oh, you know, we were talking about NASCAR running at Road America.
Right.
All right. Well, Howard Hawks, a great director, who, boy, did some fabulous movies with Bogart and Bacall, and name a great guy. You know, my favorite old films, a lot of them are the Hawks films. Did a film called Red Line 7000 with James Caan in it. And it is the typical, in some ways, early to mid-60s NASCAR film that has all the guys that were in NASCAR. They did track announcing, and they all get film bits, and they're kind of over-animated and stuff. But it really is kind of an intriguing film because it's a good snapshot of NASCAR when they ran stock cars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not stock sort of looking cars.
Not decals,
you know, and not...
There it is.
And not, you know, not eight-cylinder front or rear-wheel drive Camrys, which I still can't figure out where you buy one of those.
And with a carburetor, no. They've gotten rid of these.
Were stock cars with stock sheet metal, obviously thinned and lightened,
yep.
And they, you know, they put rudimentary roll bars in the interior. They started to do cages... kind of rudimentary cages in like 66.
I was going to say, it's about the time this film was made, when they started doing cages. And when
is
you see
65 or 66?
65 is when it was shot. But when you see some of the accidents in here, you know why they did cages. These things are absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a movie that gets a lot of the spirit of what old racing was like. And I think that's one of the reasons I like it. Plus, Howard Hawks is the master of having people talk over each other as they do in the real world when he directs films.
Yeah.
So the dialogue in it is very real. Although,
Actually, that is 65 because I just saw Junior Johnson
in his 65 Ford,
which is on the All Extremists website this week. So yeah.
After his spectacular crash at Riverside.
Yeah, this is.
And
cool.
it's actually an entertaining race film. One of the things I like are films that capture a time and sort of communicate it when you wouldn't have been able to see it any other way. Because trust me, still photos of racing are not the same as seeing the cars move.
No, and that's why Grand Prix was so good when they showed the actual footage.
Yes.
And you saw these drivers that you read about in the history books, you know, sitting around in the pub and stuff, and it was kind of amazing. And the same for Le Mans, where you saw the actual
real
footage.
Real drivers.
Yeah, real drivers, the real footage from the race, the 917s, and...
Now that's a rather hellacious crash.
Yeah, that was a bad one. But, yeah, that is right about some of these movies, the historical context, because otherwise... You only get it on old ABC Wide World of Sports and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And even then, where has all that gone? I mean...
Well, I there's a ton of it on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, there's footage of races that you didn't even remember that they even shot. But
right.
They did.
Well, last time we talked about movies, I did criticize somewhat Grand Prix, but I have to say, I mean, you know, I loved it as a kid. I loved everything except the parts between the races as a kid. And I can never get enough of Formula One racing from that era.
Yeah.
I mean, from any era, generally.
But to see, you know,
Senna, but,
yeah, to see the scenes of Grand Prix of Gurney and Jim Clark, and they're just sitting around trying to you know, fit in the movie.
And Graham Hill, where he looked at the camera in every scene where he was there. You know, they always tell actors, don't look at the camera. And so he's going like...
Yeah. And I love when... what's the actor's name? Brian Bedford?
Brian Bedford, who could not drive a Formula One, or could not drive a manual transmission worth the name.
Right, but when he was injured and he folded himself in that low front engine Lotus that looked a lot like the van wall.
Yep.
That was pretty cool.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was some great stuff in it. And, of course, nice running on the Monza wall, which, you know, they don't run on anymore. But to see how rough that was when they attempted to shoot this.
What was amazing, too, was they decided to do it in a clever way, too. They had an articulated camera mount. So when the car went up the banking, they kept the horizon level.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, if you watch Moto Grand Prix racing on speed or whatever, when they lean a bike over, the whole world twists for you.
Yeah.
But
when
you see actually the inclination of that parabolica, it's like, my God.
And, you know, they stopped running on that.
69 or 70, wasn't it?
I think it was earlier than that.
You're right, because by the time they had wing cars, they realized the wings were going to be disastrous.
Yeah, no, it was earlier than that. Actually, I think the
68.
So 68 would have been the wing cars, yeah.
I mean, you know, and then they had the Race of Two Worlds in 59 and 60, or 60 and 61.
With USAC cars?
Where they brought Indy cars over there on that, and they all said, boy, you guys are crazy. This banking's so rough. But the Indy cars won it.
Yeah. Well, they had more power.
Yeah. So, I mean... Grand Prix also gave us a look at tracks back then as they existed, which
actually brings up another film, The Racers.
Yes.
That was directed by Henry Hathaway. It has Kirk Douglas in it playing an Italian, Gino Borghese.
From 57 or 50?
Or earlier than that, 54, if memory serves.
I love The Racers. And I thought it was cool.
The great stuff about The Racers is you have Kirk Douglas playing Gino Borghese, you have Lee J. Cobb playing an Italian, Commendatore Burano, who's obviously supposed to be Enzo Ferrari. Then there is a guy that's supposed to be Fangio, played by Cesar Romero, Carlos Chavez,
yeah,
and then
bad.
Gilbert Roland as, good Lord, he's Del Oro. It's the film that it gives you a great snapshot of racing at that time. That's the thing it's great for. It has dialogue like, tell him I spit in his crankcase, because that's the way drivers race, okay? racing drivers talk this way.
Yeah,
they all talk like
Kirk Douglas.
Try to do it.
And they use period cars, too.
Well, because that's when they filmed it.
Yeah.
And this is shot at Monaco, and it's Kirk Douglas on a process screen, and they had second unit stuff that shot at Monaco.
But real footage.
Real footage, exactly. So you get a feel for what the track was like then. The other thing with it is... It's hokey at sometimes, but it also gets into old Grand Prix racing where a team would have reserve drivers.
Yeah.
And they would pull a driver out of the car if he was out of the points and put another driver whose car might have retired in that car.
Right.
And they actually get into that in the film, and it's an intriguing aspect we forget about now.
Oh, yeah.
The process screen is always pretty terrifying. And, of course, the thing is it's filled with basically non-Americans in most of the roles playing foreigners. And then you have Gino Borghese, played by Kirk Douglas, saying, he was dead before you hit him, Carlos. And then you have Lee J. Cobb playing Italian, who sounds just like Lee J. Cobb from Our Man Flynn. And once you get over that, you're like, okay, I can get into this film. But it is an astonishingly, and it's entertaining film. It really is.
So after talking about Grand Prix and The Racers, what expectations do we have of the Ron Howard movie, which is shot now, but about the 1970s?
We will talk about that when we come back. Ben, let's hear from our friends at Chevrolet, and we'll come back and talk about the new Ron Howard movie, Rush.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
You know, Ron Howard doesn't make bad movies, and I was kind of intrigued on how he, you know, found this story and wanted to do it. And, you know, we won't know till we see it, but I saw some of the teaser footage on YouTube of recreating some of the scenes, and it was pretty impressive.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I will remain optimistic about it.
This is the kind of story that Ron Howard does a good job of doing. It really is. It's something that happened. And it's dramatizing reality. And he did a great job. I mean, whether you liked the film or not, the what went in to make Apollo 13 work is still amazing for a film. It really is. It told an interesting story that we all knew the outcome of. We knew how Apollo 13 ended, but it still was a movie that brought you
into it. Yeah, but we didn't know all the the stuff that went on behind it.
And that's where my expectations are here, that we're going to hear about stuff we didn't hear about before. Now, some of it, I'm sure we'll hear about stuff we didn't hear about before. Some of it may not be reality.
Well,
but
yeah,
it might
but
be film.
But
and can you do that better in a Ron Howard film versus, say, doing a documentary? Since we've just seen Senna, I mean,
well, the one thing we have is the advantage of technology,
and that's what scares me too, because with digital imaging, you can do amazing things, but you can also do things that are so amazing your brain says it's not real.
Yeah,
as good as it looks, your brain says it's not real. And to me, this is where all the Transformer films fit in. They are using state-of-the-art stuff for doing textures and so on digital imaging, but the pictures are such you don't believe it.
And certainly says this is not 1975 or 6 or whatever year they're...
Well, and that's the thing. They have the ability to recreate that digitally. So it's going to be interesting to see how it works.
I forget the name of the author now. He passed away, but he did the definitive book on the Silver Arrows.
I know the book. I don't know who wrote it. But
yeah, and that is the era I wanted to see someone like Ron Howard do, because I would be fascinated how Hollywood car building would build these facsimiles of the auto unions and the Mercedes. Yeah.
The politics alone of what happened then would be amazing to discuss. I mean, they really would. The problem is, I think one of the problems of the film is to do it right, you would need the cooperation of both Audi and Mercedes.
And guess what? You know what's happening in Goodwood in September.
Yes, I do.
And a lot of people don't know. I mean, I had to tell Johann Denison it was happening. He hadn't heard.
What?
Yeah.
Well, I hadn't heard.
Yeah. So. What they're doing is they're taking every auto union and every Mercedes Grand Prix car that exists pre-war.
Yeah.
They've been working on them for 6 months, making them mechanically absolutely perfect. And they're going to run together at Goodwood in a special race.
Yeah.
And it'll be
a race is a word that appears in quotes here.
Well, yeah, but it'll be the last time
we will
see this.
Absolutely
ever.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be pretty special. And on that note, we have to go to rapid fire because it's that time in the show. I mean, because we could talk about this for about 14 other shows. We didn't even get the tip of the iceberg.
But that's fine.
Okay, Ben, let it rip. All right, we're back. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly because it is called rapid fire.
Yeah, and we have like 30 seconds.
We have a bunch of questions about the ATS. Is it powerful enough with the base motor? How is GM? Kevin E. Dempsey says, how is GM going to sell the ATS 4 Turbo this fall at the same price as the CTS? That's not really true.
No.
No, it's not.
No.
No, that's just, no, that's not going to.
They have an impressive number, by the way. The EPA numbers are 22 and 32.
Yeah, and remember, the volume, they believe the volume engine is going to be the 2-liter turbo, and I think they're right. I really do.
Mm-hmm. And that's the 2232 MPG
correct.
Number.
Correct. Yeah. And I have no doubt that's going to perform well. I have no doubt the V6 is going to actually be a very sweet piece. Yeah.
Remember, this pushes the price up on the CTS, especially the next generation car, which gets bigger.
And it gets larger.
Which was the plan.
Right.
Yeah. Dr. Botox says, how many Dodge Polaris were total in the first Blues Brothers movie? 120 plus? Blues Brothers is great.
It is. I saw a number I didn't believe.
I thought it was in the 80s.
It was. The number I saw was like 88 cars were totaled. And it wasn't. That didn't include just the Polaris. It also included some of the full-size Chevys that were crashed as well.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the intermediate Dodges. But it was a lot of cars. I mean, when they're just flying under the L.
It's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Frank from New Jersey. Hi, guys. I've been reading reviews of the Tesla Model S, and the reviews have been very good. Frank Marcus of Motor Trend was practically drooling, which is a good enough endorsement for me. Do you think Mercedes or Toyota or maybe someone else will buy Tesla in a year or so?
Well, Mercedes and Toyota both have, some money
into
it. They're helping out.
They will have competition from a major manufacturer or two, and it may not be Toyota or Mercedes because they'll be using some of that technology. Yeah. But Tesla's exposure is from having another company do what they're doing with a brand and a dealer network.
Comment from Dr. Olds 88. Why doesn't GM sell a hot hatch in the U.S. like the Focus ST, Fiat 500, Abarth, or GTI? Well, they're kind of hoping.
Chevy Sonic.
Yeah, the Sonic. They're probably, they're coming
out. Yeah,
it's
not hot, though.
Well, they're coming out with a hotter version of it.
Yeah, they need it.
Glenn E., do you think the Dodge Dart SRT4 will be front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive? Thank you. It will be front-wheel drive.
Absolutely, yeah. And part of it is the platform. There's no all-wheel drive readily available for it.
Right.
This guy, Sandy Barua, mentions Ronin. Yes, we got to that. Frank from New Jersey, I think Toyota taking a hybrid to Le Mans was brilliant. I would love to see Ford or GM go to Le Mans for an all-out win. I've been saying that for years, blah, blah, blah.
The amazing thing about the Toyota hybrid was that when it came into the pits, as soon as it crossed the speed limiter thing, the engine switched off and it came in under electric power. So it was creepy as all get out, where it's going, and it left under electric power until the guy pulled the pit lane limiter, and then the engine fired up at that out marker by the lights. So it would be rolling, and all of a sudden, it was pretty impressive.
Yeah, B. Wolf says, any opinions on the newly announced Siri Eyes Free by Apple that GM would be... might be using?
Well, I guess they made that announcement, and something like 6 out of the 8 car companies they mentioned had no idea they were going to do that. So,
yeah.
Brian says, in regard to Le Mans, what changes do you see required for Corvette Racing to get back in the winner's circle? Don't forget Corvette Racing won 2 years ago. I mean, sometimes bad stuff happens in races.
That's racing.
And that's racing, and believe me, the Corvettes were right there, but, you know, you can't.
They were running well when they didn't have little problems off the track.
Yeah, and then it all went wrong, which it can happen in racing.
As it did for Toyota this year.
Yes. Is CVT the only future that AMC Eagle Ragtop mentions? No. I mean...
CVT the future? No. It's the past, unless you're Nissan, which... Yeah.
You have
well
a serious commitment, but...
But 6, 7, 8, 9 speed automatics are the future.
Ben, do we have a phone call? Except I don't know if we can hear him.
Maybe it's time for you to do it, Jim.
All right, we'll keep. Now,
this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. What does the panel think about GM making the 2.5-liter four-cylinder the base engine in the new ATS? Is this a good move or a bad move? You know, I'm sure it'll be adequate, but I do not think the words adequate and Cadillac should ever be uttered in the same sentence.
I'm going to start on me.
Well, I could start, except that I've driven the engine in
something
the
else.
New Malibu. Yeah, okay. I just gave it away, but I can't tell you what I thought, except that, you know, obviously it's a price point engine for the car.
The concern I have is it's Cadillac with a Chevy engine, because the engine is basically, I mean, it's an engine out of a Malibu. Cadillacs are supposed to be giving you something extra. You got to justify it, and it's not just the hood ornament. It's obviously a cafe play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really obviously a cafe play. And when Cadillac has to do cafe plays, something's wrong with their strategic positioning of Cadillac. That car should have two engines in it. It should be the standard, should be the 2-liter turbo at 270 plus horsepower and the 3.6 optional. And then when they do a V, they could do a twin turbo version of that, and it should be just dandy. Thank you.
Which, again, do I have it right that the 2232 is for the 2-liter turbo, or is that for the 2.5?
Do I have the
engines mixed up?
I don't know.
Okay.
Glenn E. asks, any EcoBoost 4 or 6-cylinder diesels in the USA plan?
Doesn't look like it.
No. Doesn't look like it.
Looks like the only guys who right now are going to do an early smallish car diesel, looks like it's going to be Chevy with a Cruze. And apparently there's something happening involving a Fiat engine, possibly in the Dart. But the operative word there is possibly.
Yeah. Test Drive Junkie says, do you think the demise of the physical paper auto mags, which isn't quite there yet, will also lead to them losing their online presence, or will that stay intact? I think he's referring to the fact that they're moving Road and Track to...
Maybe. All I can speak to is Motor Trend, and we find that our online readers and our magazine readers are two different groups of people. There's some overlap, but a lot of independent online readers, and so that gives us hope.
Yeah. Want to try a phone call again? Sure. Okay, go ahead, Ben.
Hi, John. This is Frank in West Haven, Connecticut. I'm just calling with a quick question about the new Cadillac ATS. I keep seeing all of these different reports that there will be a two-door and a convertible. There won't be a two-door and a convertible. Any ideas what's going to go on with expanding that lineup? Thanks.
They've delayed all that.
Yeah.
The convertible, the last I heard, sounded like it was indefinitely on hold and will probably stay that way for this life cycle. The problem with the convertible is that when you look at the total volume of convertibles that they do for 3 Series and for the CLK, for the Lexus IS, and for the Infiniti G, it's not a high volume, but the incremental tooling you need for that is pretty high. And I think they looked at it and said, there's no business case there. Now, they need it to have the right product lineup to be in the segment.
Exactly. I mean, GM showed us a coupe version a long time ago,
right.
Concept version. Sheet metal's changed quite a bit since
radically,
then.
Radically, actually.
But, you know, for cost reasons, that's been put on hold, and they're hoping to get it back, but no
The thing is, if they turn
sight.
It back on, you're probably talking about the car more than a year from now.
Yeah.
So it gets a shorter part of the life cycle. It's just
exactly.
a problem.
So yeah. Mitch W. says, what's the story behind the new 911's manual gearbox? Who's shifting? The computer? I drove the new 911 and the manual, and it's fabulous, so I was shifting.
I just say I don't want. I want
the PDK.
I want the PDK. In the
I've only
myself.
Driven the PDK so far,
and the PDK is damn sweet.
It's damn good, but I'd still take the three pedal.
I have driven a 7-speed manual once in my life from a manufacturer that never put it in production, and it was absolutely you got lost in the gears. Literally, I mean, there were times you're like, now where am I? And it had an indicator, like it had head-up indicator, had an indicator on the dash and thing down here, but I was still like, just give me the PDK because I'm still shifting it. I'm just using my hands. Both hands.
Yeah. Here's a good question from Brian. What about movies, TV shows that do a disservice to cars? Or will that list be too long? Yeah, that would be really long. Yeah. I nominate a little 1978 NBC miniseries starring Rock Hudson called
Wheels.
Arthur Haley's Wheels.
Oh, with the La Mancha.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was just, and the cars were awful. They had a.
That was horrendous.
Customized Dodges and stuff. They're just awful. Just
I missed
awful.
That one completely, thankfully.
It was horrible, but it was good because it was horrible. You know, we forgot a movie that I just want to mention that was also a TV movie, Vanishing Point.
Oh, yeah. Man. Vanishing okay. Point.
I thought we mentioned that in our first.
That wasn't a TV movie.
Yes, there was a 1987 TV movie of Vanishing Point.
I thought we mentioned that in our first
The Vanishing Point movie I saw in the theater.
71.
Right.
Oh, you're talking about
it. It was a 1980 and
oh, you're right.
It was awful.
And
it was awful.
Sucked.
It was awful.
The 71 was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I mean, because they were really driving.
We mentioned it, but we have clips of it now. We didn't have it before, so that's why I'm mentioning Vanishing Point.
Yeah.
But there's a TV movie that took this thing and just totally ran it into the ash can.
Well, there's always the Betsy.
Oh, a turbine-powered Lancia Beta. What could be a more exciting car?
Okay, here's a question, and this will be it. My name is Scott.
That's not a question.
Hello, Scott.
Oh.
My question for you guys is, since the Camaro is going to the Alpha platform and Zeta is no longer going to be used in the Camaro, why not keep Zeta and use it for a Monte Carlo? Better yet, to Peter's point, a new Riviera, or use the long wheelbase of Zeta like in the Caprice PPV and make a CL. I'm still waiting for the 2014 Chevy SS to come out.
Well, that will be Zeta.
Yeah.
I mean, that'll be the next generation or an evolved Zeta.
Zeta's going to be around. What you're going to see is you're going to see Alpha basically be a small to mid rear-wheel drive platform.
Right.
It's going to be used for things like the production version of the Code 130R, whatever they call it. Hopefully they change the name. Sorry.
no, and then, don't be sorry about
and
that.
And then you're going to see there's the larger Omega platform that information has started to leak out about, and that's going to be probably a Cadillac-exclusive platform, except for China. So what you have is Zeta to be Holdens, Chevrolets, Buicks if the market needs them, and I don't think the market in the U.S. does need them myself, but it does need them for China. So I think you're going to see, and you're going to see a second-generation Zeta that's more more high-strength steel to get its mass down, because Zeta is porky.
I think that the Chevrolet SS is going to be popular for certain demographic. I think it'll probably be well done. It'll be nice to look at.
And the best part of it is there'll be a police version, too.
Right. So before we put the campfire out, I'd like to remind you, don't forget, in 2 weeks, AutoLine After Hours will be broadcasting our second annual automotive draft. It was very popular last year, and this year's going to be much better. And so we've got that to look forward to.
Go Bustango Motors.
Yeah.
Support Bustango Motors. Remember Bustango's motto, you won't believe it's not inexpensive.
I'd like to thank Todd Lassa from Motor Trend. Todd, always a pleasure.
Peter.
And Jim Hall from 2953 Analytics. Always good to see you, Jim.
Thanks, Peter.
And you can see all my stuff at AutoExtremist.com. And I'm on Twitter. Peter M. DiLorenzo. It used to be Auto Extremist, but now it's my name. And there's a Facebook page for Auto Extremist that my buddy AJ Morning monitors for me, but I don't really care about. And you can friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit, or you can follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And we'd really like to thank you for joining us and thank Bridgestone and Chevy again, and we hope everyone has a safe 4th celebrating America's Independence Day. Good night.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.